Hello and welcome to the Let's Talk Bipolar podcast, hosted by Emma Bell and brought to you by Bipolar UK. You can find all of our resources at www.bipolaruk.org. Welcome to this week's episode of Let's Talk Bipolar. And this is actually a bonus episode that I'm doing with Simon Kitchen, who is the CEO of Bipolar UK. And we're doing a special episode because it's Suicide Prevention Day this week. And it's really important because suicide prevention is a real issue that we need to talk about within the bipolar community, because people that have bipolar are at increased risk of suicide. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Simon. We're going to talk a little bit about him, and you're going to get to know him, and then we're going to talk about Suicide Prevention Day and what we can do to help people in this community. So hi Simon, how are you?
Hi Emma, doing really good, thanks. Thank you so much for inviting me on the podcast.
Well, it is kind of your podcast that you should be on, really.
I know. I can't believe it's taken me this long to get on it. So thanks, Emma, for getting me, kind of making sure I come on. So it's a real pleasure to talk to you and your audience as well.
Yeah. And it's an important week for Bipolar UK, because Suicide Prevention Day is key for this community, and raising awareness of suicide prevention can and will help to save lives. So before we go into that, can you tell us a bit about you and why and how you're involved with Bipolar UK?
Hi Emma, so in terms of my career, it's been a bit all over the place. I started off working in regeneration, analysing regeneration programmes, so going into poor communities and just asking people about whether the monies that were spent on their behalf were useful and helping improve their lives. I then worked in the civil service for a bit in the Sustainable Development Commission, looking at environmental policy, and then moved into the charity sector, which is where I've been probably for about 10 years now. So first of all, I was at Alzheimer's Society, where I ran a thing called the Dementia Action Alliance. And then I was at Leonard Cheshire Disability, and now I'm running Bipolar UK. But it's been a common theme throughout my career, I guess, which is around trying to empower people who have often been the kind of neglected by different policy areas and public services, and making sure that they're able to get the support they need to lead the lives they want to lead, and also to see them as part of the solution, which is really so important. And that's why I'm kind of really passionate about the charity that we run here at Bipolar UK, because the ethos is all about peer support, and it's all about mobilizing people with bipolar to support other people with bipolar, because it's a community that's got huge talents and abilities.
One of the perks of bipolar is that, you know, but it's true, right? Like, this is a multi sort of face, multi-layered condition, and yes, there's some tough parts, but there's some brilliance that can come out of some of the waves that we ride as living with bipolar. And out of that, you know, the people in this community have a lot to offer. And I love what you say about the peer support aspect, because that was my first interaction with Bipolar UK, was going to, when you weren't named Bipolar UK at the time, I have to say, but I was going to one of your peer support groups, and I'd been to a therapist, but there's something so powerful about being in a room with other people who just get it. And it makes you suddenly don't feel othered. You feel, oh, okay, I'm not a complete, you know, I'm not a freak. I'm not these things, you know, I'm not something to be scared of. Because there was a part of me that was kind of scared to identify with that piece. You know, I've got bipolar. What does that mean? What's everyone going to think? And then you go in a room and you say some of your, what you feel are your most crazy things, and people sort of nod and you think, oh, it's okay, I'm safe, right? And it's incredibly powerful. And it was a huge part of my journey to being empowered to speak and give back to others, you know. So Bipolar UK is enormous for so many people, I know personally.
Thanks, Emma. No, I really appreciate that. And most people, before they get a diagnosis, don't know anyone else with bipolar. They probably do know someone with bipolar. About one in 50 people have bipolar. So if you know 150 people, you're going to know at least three people with bipolar. But people are understandably very private about their diagnosis, because a lot of fear and a lot of stigma around it. And also, a lot of people with bipolar don't actually have a diagnosis. It can take, it can be publishing some research on this, but it takes around 10 years to get a diagnosis mm-hmm. from first symptoms. So a lot of people do, they say stuff that they regret mm-hmm. and they really carry that themselves. And it's a real burden on themselves because they really regret some of their behaviors. And actually getting a diagnosis and then connecting to other people with bipolar helps you kind of disaggregate what's the bipolar and what's me. Mm. And also to give a sense of meaning as well. Like most people, we always find like getting a diagnosis was a difficult moment for them, but it was also a moment that gave them some clarity and mm-hmm. self-awareness as well, and some self-acceptance. Mm-hmm. And as we always try to run the charity as knowing that people will become unwell and do stuff that they regret. We always run the charity as a charity of second chances, so that mm-hmm. people might say and do stuff. They might say offensive things on our e-community and they'll get suspended for a bit, but once they're better again, they come back, and we'd always welcome people back in because it's really important that people get that second chance to be able to rebuild their lives.
I think that's absolutely fundamental. And that acceptance without judgment is the piece that will allow people to unburden themselves from shame. Because actually it's the shame that is, well, we'll go on to talk about suicide prevention now, but it's actually shame that can be a real trigger for that piece of us. And I'll say a piece of us because it's not all of us, a part of us that thinks, I can't see a way out of this, because the shame does become very heavy and it can be a complete trigger for suicidal ideation, action, intent. So to be a part of a community where all of you is accepted and given heaps of grace, which is exactly what you need with bipolar, you can move through life without feeling ashamed. And I think if we can unburden ourselves from shame, it's a massive step in the right direction.
Absolutely. And being able to, as you said earlier, be part of a community mm-hmm. as well. I mean, mm-hmm. being part of the community would kind of help and burden that shame.
Yes.
But also that it's joining a tribe and a family. Mm-hmm. And I'd love it if people with bipolar, if they all knew who each other was, but not the whole world did. So it's almost like a secret society. And then people can then have that sort of connection. And also it's like friends and family as well. That's a really massive part of our community, and we're there for them because they're affected by bipolar.
But
I do believe that if we could just mobilize every single person who's, even not everyone, just a good core group of people who are got that personal experience of bipolar, either living with themselves or close friends and family, that we can get all the support we need to the people within our community, and we can mean that everyone with bipolar can lead the life they want to lead. It's just about finding them, mobilizing them, and then just kind of keeping them organized and providing that mutual support, which is so vital.
Yeah, it really is. So Suicide Prevention Day is this week. I would love to talk to you about the importance of that for the bipolar community. Do you know what are the statistics for suicide within the bipolar community for those that attempt suicide and those that complete suicide?
So we've just been doing some work on that as part of our bipolar commission. And there's two different sets of numbers that say two different things. So there's a one which is looking at suicide studies. So these are ones which have been done where they go through coroner reports and they'll go through what they call a psychological autopsy, where they'll go and talk to family. And from those ones, they would say, looking from the perspective of suicide, to say probably around 5% of all suicides in the UK are by people with bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about one in 20, which is a horrific number in and of itself, which motivates us to do the work that we do. But there are, if you look at it from the perspective of people living with bipolar, so lots of studies say that having bipolar increases the risk of suicide by 20 times. You look at the prevalence data and then you look at what the community tell us, and we think that and the number of people who are undiagnosed as well, which is a big factor. So it could be double that. So it could be talking about 10-15% of all suicides in the UK could be by people living with bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a real challenge for us as a charity, and that's why we do the work that we're doing, is to really bring that down. Now, there's some factors that complicate that, which is in a good way, which is that getting access to treatment makes a massive difference. So if you're taking lithium, the risk of suicide is dramatically reduced, pretty much down to the general public.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you're getting other support and treatment, and if you're not unwell and you're able to stay in what we call a euthymic state, which is kind of a balanced state, when we use the mood scale, that's like a 4 to a 6, then that will dramatically reduce the risk of suicide. So there's no inevitability that if you've got bipolar that you've got that the suicide risk is going to have to stay high. There's things you can do to dramatically reduce it. So the suicide stats say that it's probably around about, it's probably about 5% the minimum, mm-hmm. and it could be up to, we think it's probably closer to about 10-12%.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of suicide attempts, I mean, we just did some survey work on that, and we were really shocked that it was about 60% of the people that responded had said that they'd attempted suicide at mm-hmm. some point, and about 10% over the last year. So that really worries us, and we want to be able to support them to be able to mm-hmm. to dramatically reduce the risk. And we've got going to be putting lots of resources up on our website, including your excellent podcast mm-hmm. that you've done
with Chris Brown. She's amazing. She's been in. Yeah. This is her jam. Suicide prevention. She's so passionate about it, especially going into the sort of sub vulnerable categories within our communities as well, of those that are at risk of suicide. And her suicide prevention work is outstanding. She's incredible. I took her training nearly 10 years ago now, and she was fundamental in the Stay Alive app, which is free to download. And she's just a wonderful human being who is so passionate about giving people skills, tools, resources to help themselves keep safe from suicide. So the approach comes from the ASSIST model, which is from Canada. So it's a proven model of education. And it shows that if we can tackle it head on, the topic, not be afraid, use the right language, give people the right tools, which is language mostly, and for the people around those that are suicidal to understand that it's not your job to fix that. It's your mm-hmm. job to be a stepping stone, a signpost, a direction, just mm-hmm. to bridge that gap, to get enough time to get them to help. Because I think that's why people feel afraid, because they think, well, if I ask and they say yes, then I've got to fix this and I'm out of my depth and I don't know what to do. And it's scary. Let's face it. Let's be truthful. It's scary when you feel like someone's life could potentially be in your hands. That is a scary thing. And Chris is really passionate in educating people to understand that their life isn't in your hands. Nobody's life is your responsibility. You can be a stopgap. You can be a signpost. You can be the person to ring the bell, get help. But ultimately, you're not responsible for somebody else's life. And that, I think, empowers everybody to feel less afraid, because mm-hmm. then we understand where we fit in that puzzle. Oh, I'm not I don't suddenly have to be a psychiatrist, doctor, A&E, nurse, you know, CPR. I just need to be the person to say to that person, how long can you keep yourself for? So keep yourself safe for, and you know, what's your network? And let's build a safety plan and let's get you to help, right? And I think that is less scary for those supporting people that are suicide than thinking, if they say, yes, I've got to try and fix this and be all the things, which is completely overwhelming, I think, for people.
I mean, that's excellent advice, isn't it? And we deal with it on a weekly basis within our charity. I mean, we're not a crisis service, but a lot of the people that we support are often in crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of our staff and our volunteer have got like lived experience of bipolar and other mental health conditions. And like, we want to help support them to be able to help them. And it's really important that I always say to the staff that when we're signposting people to support, that we can't fix the problem, but we can do the best that we can in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
So making sure people get access to like emergency services. I mean, that's a really crucial one, and referring people onto crisis team. We'll call up the crisis team and we'll get the crisis team notified. We'll even call up ambulances for people. But a lot of the time it's giving people permission to be able to access emergency services, which is really vital. And we use the analogy of like with diabetes, that if someone was having a diabetic shock, you wouldn't ever hesitate to call an ambulance if you didn't have the insulin there to be able to help them. You would just call the ambulance. They're not well. Get them some emergency help. And that's exactly the same for if you're feeling suicidal. It's not, there might be underlying causes that are meaning you're depressed, but suicidal ideation is the technical term, or suicidal thinking it's something that's not going right in your head and you're not well. And you need to be able to have your permission to talk to emergency services to be able to get the support you need. We'd always call it as a psychiatric emergency. So like a paramedic should come out and the police if necessary, and they'll be able to get you the help that you need to stay well in that moment. Because it is a feeling that will pass. And with the help and the support and keeping yourself during that moment, then things will get better. That's the crucial thing to always remember.
That's true, yeah. And it is funny, isn't it, how when it comes to our emotional and mental health, we suddenly can categorize it differently to another medical emergency, yet it's just as serious. And the bit that I love about Chris, which people will hear in the bigger podcast, the main episode, is she's really passionate about empowering those that are having suicidal ideation to understand that they're not powerless. And by asking simple questions like, how long do you feel you can keep yourself safe for? It's a really empowering question for everyone, because the asker then gets a benchmark of what we're dealing with. And it actually gives, say it was me, it gives me the opportunity to sort of take ownership of how I'm feeling a bit and say, well, actually, half an hour. And then we kind of all know where we stand, right? And the appropriate action can be taken. So, I mean, her work is just incredible. I think she's been doing like 20 odd, 25 years or something, specializing in this field. So, I mean, yeah, go listen, everyone. It's a great episode. And Chris has a lot to give. She's a wonderful human. And this is her passion. So I hope that episode helps everyone. So what's Bipolar UK doing? Because I'm doing something with you for Suicide Prevention Day. So tell us all about it.
So we just want to raise the risk of suicide within the community. The vast majority of people with bipolar will not complete suicide. I mean, that's, I think it's probably worth not scaring people.
Yeah.
Like 90-95% of people with bipolar will unfortunately die of other natural causes. But we want to get that. We want to make sure that people with bipolar are just aware of that risk, and then to be able to take proactive steps to reduce it. And also to be able to kind of undo some of the stigma attached to suicide as well. Certainly having a more open conversation about it is really important. And we always say, if you talk about suicide, that's going to reduce the risk. If you talk but never talk about the means, that's the crucial thing to do. Like, if you talk about suicide and have an open conversation, you said there, the advice that Chris was giving, then that will that kind of opens up the possibility to then people then to access support. And people shouldn't be scared of having that conversation.
It's funny, isn't it, that myth, you know, everyone, there's that fear that if we talk about suicide, it might increase the risk and it might push someone to do it. But the proven research and studies actually show that if we tackle that conversation head on, you know, are you feeling suicidal? Is this where you're at right now? The proven research and studies have shown that actually it reduces the risk. So it goes against what our fear is telling us. But the studies show that actually it will reduce that risk, because it gives that person permission to go, yeah, that's where I'm at. Or no, I'm not, that's not where I'm at. I'm just having a really bad day, or, you know. So, so it goes against the fear narrative of, oh, if we talk about it, it might push them. You know, it's actually the complete opposite, like you say.
And we think we also, the public services need to play a big role in this, and people with bipolar can't do it all by themselves. I mean, if you said suicide prevention should be part of everyone's self-management plan, like safety plans is a really good resource for that. I know, I think Papyrus have got a number on there, got some on their website. They're a really good charity. But also that we think that bipolar, because of the nature of the condition, should be a special consideration within public policy as well. So in the same way that the kind of that we'll look at farming and suicide and vets and suicide, and bipolar, the risk of suicide is probably even higher than those communities. And I think it's just flagging within the system that this is something that needs to be taken seriously, and we need to be looking at kind of what are the specific needs of people with bipolar. So like lithium, for example, I always talk about lithium. I'm not a clinician. I'm not a pharmacist. So I would always recommend, if you're ever talking, thinking about taking different medication, talk to your pharmacist, your GP, and your psychiatrist first. But lithium is a treatment for the majority of people with bipolar. It can be like a really amazing treatment. It really effective as side effects. But in terms of suicide reduction, it's really, really effective. In Sweden, it's about 70% of people with bipolar take lithium. In the UK, we don't know exactly, but it's probably between about one in 20, or we're just doing some survey where it came at about one in three. So we would want to see within public policy, what is the government's plan around getting people having medication reviews so that they're able to get onto lithium, for example, if it works for them. If it doesn't, then people should be on other medication, but at least give people the opportunity to see whether it works for them. Another thing that we would want to see is pushing up the diagnosis rate. There's quite a bit of research around the highest risk around suicide is immediately after diagnosis, but we would get that, we would kind of infer from that that it's probably the period leading up to it where people are at higher risk. And this one of the issues around it's really difficult to estimate accurate suicide stats for the community. So we believe if we can get the diagnosis rate up, get people diagnosed earlier, then that means they can get treatment and support earlier. Mm-hmm. And then it means that they're not going to get into such a desperate state where they're at high risk of ending up in hospital, and obviously the risk around suicide as well. So getting the diagnosis rate up will be a really important thing for NHS to be able to prioritise. And then finally, access to support services. So obviously peer support is really helpful for people, but the community can't do it all by itself. And actually when we consistently ask, what would you want, what would reduce your risk of like suicidal thinking? About 40% of people who responded to our recent survey said better access to a psychiatrist.
Yes.
And that's so, so vital. And having a consistency of care. So having one psychiatrist that you might have throughout your life until they retire, that you can always just call on, and they might give you a call once every 6 months. You might go in, have a comprehensive consultation maybe every couple of years. But even when you're well, you've always got that psychiatrist that you can call on, because that saves so much time, because they know your case history and they can pick up when you might be become more manic or more depressed, and they will know the different medication you're taking. And one of the big risks that we see at the moment is that there's a trend towards what's called episodic care, which is we'll support someone with bipolar when they become unwell, because that's on paper more efficient. And we just get them access to any psychiatrist to be able, or GP, just to be able to make sure they get more frequent support when they're unwell. But actually, that's not what people say they want. They don't want to get ill in the first place. They want to be supported to stay well, because for all manner of reasons, not least wanting to just have a career, have a family, everything that people want to do, go traveling. I mean, being unwell just takes up so much of people's lives, and they do so much to it. That just being able to support people to stay well for longer should be a top priority. And access to psychiatrists more frequently.
Well, it's the difference between crisis care management and care management, right?
Yeah.
Like, if we're just looking after people in crisis, then we're going to have to expect that we're going to be yo-yoing their care plan forevermore. And consistent care providers, I think, is really key. Because there are periods, if you can get stable, then actually it's just like we just keep kind of topping up, you know, rather than this all or nothing approach, which doesn't, and it doesn't lead to sustainable stability for anybody living with bipolar. I know that firsthand. And you know, for me, I think I got diagnosed 14 years after I first had symptoms, maybe. I first had symptoms when I was 15 and got diagnosed when I was 29. And if I think about it, that was mostly because I only presented when I was so low. So therefore I got diagnosed with depression and then got put on medication and then went into a manic state because I was on the wrong medication. So it just became this, you know, disaster, really. Perhaps when people present with depression, they should not only be given the GAD and the PHQ-9, they should also be given a bipolar assessment questionnaire at the same time, because the likelihood of someone coming in when they're hypermanic and managing life, which is society acceptable in society to be super productive, super on it, is seen as a win, like it seemed like you're acing life. It goes missed. And if you are sort of hovering between depression and hypomania, actually you could never present to the doctor in a higher state. So perhaps what needs to be happening is when someone comes in, when they're very low, they actually need to be given anxiety, depression, and a bipolar questionnaire all at the same time by their GP. And perhaps that, if that had happened to me, I would have been picked up by psychiatry far sooner, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's a massive issue. A lot of people get misdiagnosed with, with depression. I think it's about 30%. It's some huge stat. And about 10% of those who have got kind of taken antidepressants have actually got bipolar.
Yeah.
It's one study we looked at. And then it's kind of undiagnosed.
But, you know, that questionnaire takes, what, 60 seconds?
Yeah.
It's just an extra piece of paper.
I mean, officially, they're supposed to do it. It's part of the NICE guidelines. GPs are supposed to ask about high moods, but people wouldn't necessarily, because there's still a lot of, partly because of the fear around bipolar and there's a lot of ignorance still, people don't necessarily recognize the hypomanic state. I mean, before I took this job, I wasn't familiar with it. But it's amazing how many people are they've had these really productive periods where they're really high achievers, and then they'll just present with a depression. And then one of the problems that happens is they'll get prescribed antidepressants, and a lot of people with bipolar, that can then trigger a serious manic, full-on manic episode.
Yeah.
And then that's even harder to recover from after that.
Yeah. That's been my story twice.
Wow.
Yeah, twice. So when I was 15 and then again when I was 29.
And the GPs didn't even pick up on it. I mean,
the second time around, my friend came around when I went into my second manic episode and was like, this isn't just depression. There's something more going on here because this isn't normal. You need to go back. And that's when they did the tracking. I mean, I was completely unaware of bipolar at 15, but if someone had given me the bipolar questionnaire and said, I wouldn't necessarily have known what I was answering, but I would have answered it, because to me that was I would have just ticked it, thinking that was normal, in all honesty. Yeah. Probably would have been more inclined to answer it if it didn't have bipolar at the top, but you know, if it was just like mood questionnaire, I would have just ticked that and maybe it would have got picked up sooner. So yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, how healthcare in the UK is just so focused on the initial presentation that it's like they get a telescope out on the one issue you're bringing to them, rather than just saying, okay, let's just look wider and do all of the kind of observation. So anyway, for me, if I'd have had all three, I think it might have been picked up a bit sooner. But of course, I present with depression, so they give me an anxiety and depression questionnaire.
Well, I think it's hard for GPs because they're naturally generalists. And I think it was, I was chatting to someone, and don't quote me on this, because someone listening who's like kind of head of a deanery or something like that. But I think they get 2 days on mental health, and they get one of those days is on depression and anxiety, and then the rest of it's all the other mental health conditions all together. So that's not a lot.
No.
I think if people are coming in with depression, though, I think getting people to do the MDQ, as it's called, it could be quite a good tool, and it does over-screen for people who are younger relative to people who are older. So it's not perfect, but I think it's certainly a start. One of the things that we're going to what we're piloting and going to be launching hopefully in the autumn, just for beta testing, is an app to help people monitor their mood.
Yeah.
Because there's not an online screening tool and there's not a blood test that can say you definitively got bipolar, but mood monitoring is really effective. So the idea is that someone would go download the app, and it's really interesting seeing about like if putting the title bipolar on it might put people off, because we probably want lots of people to download it and use it even if they didn't have bipolar, because mm-hmm. we think it'd be really helpful just to get as many people as possible kind of just tracking their moods. Mm-hmm. But they go in, do a very short questionnaire, and then you could then track your mood, saying about the highs and the lows. And then when you go and see your GP, you can then present it to them, and you can actually then have a kind of track, what did the GP ask you about your mood? And you can present the data to them. Because actually, if you go to a GP, it's really frustrating. And you say, I think I've got bipolar. They're really not interested, because they don't like being told how to do their job. if you go and you start presenting the symptoms in a way that they can then recognize, mm-hmm. so you can say, well, I've been really depressed, but I've also had these periods of high moods. Could you please help me understand what that might be? Mm-hmm. Then you're much more likely to get a better response, or like say, can I speak to a psychiatrist about this? Mm-hmm. And that might well get a better response from it, mm-hmm. from a GP. So hopefully if we had this app, it could help people have better conversations.
That'd be amazing. I mean, that's what I advise. A lot of people contact me, you know, through social media, because I'm open, and they say, you know, I think I might have bipolar. And I say that to them, the best thing you can do is track your mood. And I share with them the resources that I have, but an app would be amazing. So when you have that, I'll be sharing that. And I say, because if you go with nothing, they actually can't really help you. Whereas if you go and say, I've tracked my mood for the last X amount of time, and this is my reality, you'll find that it will be easier to access psychiatry, psychology, because you'll qualify under the criteria that needs it, you know, mm-hmm. rather than having to go away and do that. Because that's all they're going to do is say, well, or they might not, they might just give you a diagnosis of depression like me, right? But ultimately, you're going to have to give your stats to get the help you need at some point in your journey. So even for me to access psychiatry, I had to see a mental health nurse, had to track my mood for a certain amount of time. And that was the starting place for getting my diagnosis. So you're completely right. By having that app, we can go in at a GP level and say, I've done the stats, now where's the help, right? And it does fast track it. It absolutely does.
Mm. Yeah, so much, because we can't just rely on the medical profession. I think it's that kind of combination of the two, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Community and the NHS playing their parts.
Mm-hmm.
So vital. Empowering people to recognize the symptoms is going to be it's really important to be able to do that. So, and I think tackling some of the stigma around bipolar will help with that, because no one wants to have bipolar in the like whenever we ask the community, like there's lots of positive stuff about people not being ashamed of like their disabilities and so forth. And there's lots of celebrities now with bipolar being more open, which is a really good side of it. But the other side is that people do think that like people kind of, it's a fashionable condition, and it's not, like no one chooses to have bipolar.
Oh.
If we can just reduce some of the fear and stigma attached to it, then people can just be a little bit mindful of the risks then, can't they? And then, because things that people can do to manage bipolar, it's certainly, the diagnosis is not the end, it's the start.
It is the beginning, yeah. And also the piece that you said about empowering people, I think certainly for me at the beginning of my journey, I was very disillusioned, like unaware. I thought that I would go and someone would wave a magic wand and fix me. And actually I was sort of looking to the medical profession like I was completely powerless and they had all the power, and without them it wasn't possible for me to do anything. And actually the most empowering part of my journey, and as I speak to other people who live with bipolar, is understanding, no, I can own this, right? And the more responsibility I take and the more ownership I take and the more I track my mood and kind of, if I'm going to have this, I'm going to own it, then we can actually have a far more effective care plan and support in place, rather than just thinking all of the power is with the medical people. A lot of the power is with us in terms of tracking our mood, doing this, knowing about it, learning about it, like make it your business to learn everything about it, and you will feel far more empowered in every medical meeting you ever go into, ever.
Mm. Mm. Absolutely. I mean, there's the end of the day, people need to take responsibility for their health, mm-hmm. and that applies to absolutely everyone in every mm-hmm. condition. So, and everyone's got something, haven't they?
Mm-hmm.
So the more we take responsibility for the health, the better. And clinicians are there, it's a kind of partnership. They can, the gateway to, in terms of accessing medication mm-hmm. and so forth. And they know the kind of the epidemiology, I think is the term, or the kind of the bigger picture. But only people who are living with bipolar, the mm-hmm. experts in having the condition, and only that you as a person is the only person who's the expert in your bipolar.
Yes.
So I think it's a lifelong journey, and it's exhausting for a lot of people. Yeah. Like,
yeah.
I mean, having to second guess yourself all the time must be really tiring. And we were really shocked when we were doing our surveys about how it's like good things that happen to people can be a trigger for bipolar. So like starting a new job, getting a new relationship, going on holiday, all of these things that people would, like, if you were living with depression, these are the things that you might well say, these are going to help fix my life and make them better,
mm-hmm.
maybe less depressed. That, for someone with bipolar, that could trigger them into a manic episode, and they might well lose 6 months of their life to it. So
yeah.
That second guessing is so exhausting.
But
there's things you can do. I mean, like, they would always say to people, get enough sleep. Like if you get, make sure you get enough sleep. And this is, it's a bit like someone who's got risk of heart disease, eating lots of fatty foods, or someone who's got risk of lung cancer, smoking. Mm-hmm. If you've got high risk of bipolar, just make sure you sleep, like get 7 or 8 hours. And it's not always possible.
No.
When you're going into a manic episode, it's really tough. But if you just make it your mission to be able to get, like, if I do one thing today, it's to make sure I get enough sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll gear my entire day around going to bed at a good time, not taking my phone with me, having a nice bath, treating myself to a night love evening, mm-hmm. like making it as pleasurable as possible, and just gearing around getting enough sleep. And that is probably one of the most important things that you can do around mm-hmm. self-management.
Yeah, it's very hard. And you know, my husband now has, I mean, he's not a professional, but he said something to me that was really helpful about that. Because he can recognize when I'm on the higher side of things. And he also does respect the fact it's actually really hard to slow down. It's really hard to sleep. It's really, it's hard. And he said to me, well, do what you're going to do for the next hour or so. But then even if you can't sleep, at least physically rest. So even if you can't sleep and you're awake, at least let your body rest.
Mm.
Because even though your mind is going at a million miles an hour, if you keep letting your body do what your mind's doing, you will, at some point we hit exhaustion point, right? And so he was saying to me, and I'd never really thought about it before, he's like, I respect the fact your brain is going at a million miles an hour and you can't stop, but just let your body rest. Even if you just lay down and watch Netflix, like something. We're doing half the job, right? We're doing half rest.
Yeah.
And actually that was really helpful, because, you know, speak to anybody who's going into that busier phase and you tell them, you know, you think, well, that's impossible. How can I sleep? But then if you say to me, that is a bit more palatable, well, at least let your body rest. And then actually sometimes your mind might just come along, you know, you say, well, just, I'm going to let my physical self rest. You know, I'm not going to turn over the bedroom, rearrange the house, redecorate, you know, I'm going to not promise I'm going to sleep, but I'm going to physically just try and stay still, you know, and that's kind of might feel a bit more manageable to people when they're in that state, because it's hard, so hard, so hard. Oh gosh, I'm with everyone. I know it. I live it. It's hard.
It's not easy at all,
no.
Is it? I mean, there's no easy quick fixes, and no. everyone can do everything right and things can still go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some, that's what I love about the charity, is it connects up so many people who are, and everyone's got a little piece of the jigsaw.
Mm.
And it's that kind of community of mutual support. And also it's just such a wonderful empathetic community, because people have experienced had such ranges of experience.
Mm.
People are so generous, like you are with your time and with your sharing your experiences, and there's those of other people who are very generous in other ways as well. And it's people do with bipolar, I find, can are some of the most generous people that I've ever met. And
it's when you've lived it, I mean, it's something for me, 10 years in, I'm now in a space where I can give back, you know, because I'm kind of got enough tools myself to look after myself and give. And I just, you know, you just remember what it's like in the early days. And you just think, oh, if I can do anything to help somebody who's in that space that I was in then, when I really didn't know how on earth I was going to carry on and have any type of normal, and I say that in air quotes, guys, for those that are just listening, normal life, because I don't believe normal actually exists for anyone really. But, you know, you'll do it right when you've got the capacity to give. You will probably arrive in a space where you think, yeah, I've got capacity to give something back, and everyone will in this journey, I think, in their own way, whatever that is. So let's talk about Friday. So what are we doing on Friday?
So it's World Suicide Prevention Day.
Actually, I'm going to say today, because this is getting released on Friday, so this is going to get released in the morning.
Yes.
So what are we doing, guys? I'm recording this earlier in the week, but what are we doing today, because this is coming out today, Friday?
So we're really lucky. We're going to be nominated, I think, is it going to be the chair or director of Rotary International who's going to be chairing it, and he's been a really good friend to the charity. And we wanted to be able to put something out to collaborate between Bipolar UK and kind of work with Rotarians on this as well, because we know that kind of we share similar values around mutual support and community. So we wanted to put something out just to raise awareness of the risk around bipolar and suicide, and to be able to have it as fundamentally a message of hope, though. Like, talking about the risk is not going to, if we ignore it, it's not going to go away. Mm-mm. But there's loads of things that we can all do to play our own small part, as you said earlier on, to be able to dramatically reduce the risk. Mm-hmm. So around some of the things you talked about, around making people talk about it, being really open about it. You might well want to talk about how we need to have more of a plan around getting people's medication reviewed, and to be able to get kind of better access to lithium and other treatments. Talk about safety plans, all the practical things that we can do to reduce the risk within the community. And also just to talk about what the community are telling us that is important to them. Yeah. So better access to talking therapies as well, which is really important. It's not all about the medication. It's also about the social side as well, which is really important. So we'll be talking about some of the numbers. We'll be talking about, and then mostly we'll be focusing on the solutions, like what can we do to help?
Yeah.
And what would it look like to take down the risk of suicide, people with bipolar, down to a national average, which is what it should be.
Yeah.
That's the plan. So dial in. Hopefully you've already watched it, and now you're actually dialing in. You want to find out about the podcast afterwards.
Yeah. So this will be released Friday morning. So you guys will be hearing this Friday morning, maybe, or afterwards. But if you hear it in the morning, then the webinar will be later on in this same day. Thanks, Simon. Thanks for today, and it's been lovely to talk to you. Is there anything you'd like to add before we go?
Just thank you so much, Emma, for all of your amazing work, and I'd love to come on again in the future. We've got our interim bipolar commission report in the autumn, so in the 27th of October. So I'd love to be able to, why don't we catch up before then, and we'll talk through some of the findings, because that'd be really great, because I know a lot of your listeners have been inputting into it by taking surveys and so forth. So we'd really love to be able to share that as a kind of a early findings. That'd be great.
Yeah, I think that would be very good. All right. Thank you very much. And I will see you. Well, I'll talk to you before, but we will also come back on the podcast to talk about the commission findings. So thanks very much.
Thanks, Emma. Keep safe. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Let's Talk Bipolar, the podcast brought to you by Bipolar UK. Please go to our website, www.bipolaruk.org, for all of our resources and all of the support that we can offer you.